Hello and welcome to a new episode of Brain Drops, episode 9, with your usual hosts. My name is Lennart Stechmann, and with me, as always, is Dom. Hey, Dom.
Hey, Lennart. Good to be on the show again. Really excited.
Great to have you back after a nice episode with Harp. Dom, you brought our guest for today. Who is it?
I'm just gonna introduce him real quick. His name is Jordan Godfrey, and he is from England. He's a strength and conditioning coach, or also, let's say, a physical performance coach for the British BBL team, the Leicester Riders, and I'm really excited to have him on the show. Hey, Jordan, how are you?
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me on. I'm doing great. Well, as good as you can be in these situations, but happy to be on and really looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, same here. I'm really glad to have you on. How is the situation right now for you? You're living in Leicester, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm in Leicester. We're currently still in our isolation period, so kind of got limited access to a lot of things. Set regulations of, you know, you can only be outside for certain lengths of times and you can only go outside once a day. So definitely having to be creative in terms of how we're working with our athletes. But the main thing is that everyone's safe. How about yourself?
We have the privilege that we are still have our practice gym available for our players. Obviously, they're only allowed to work out individually. There is no team practice or anything, but at least still they also get exposure to the weight room, and that gives us plenty of chances, of still working out, like doing workouts with the guys. Jordan, just, please give me or give the listeners a little introduction about yourself. And maybe also touch on how everything started for you that you became a strength and conditioning coach or physical performance coach.
Yeah, of course. So firstly, kind of how most strength coaches tell their story is that they were either the unathletic guy on their team or the injured guy. And that's how they got exposure to strength and conditioning. But I was both of them. So I had the luck of being the unathletic player and also being injured all the time. So by the time when I got to university, I did my undergrad at the University of Birmingham. That was my first exposure to strength conditioning when I was there. And, I was having to work closely with them a lot because I was always interested in how I can improve my physical performance. And then it got to the point where I then had to prioritize trying to stay healthy and getting on the court. So that was my first exposure. I did my undergrad, University of Birmingham, as I said. Whilst I was there, I started an internship with the performance team that they have at the university that trains the university teams. So I started that in my first year when I was 18. All 3 years of my undergrad, I worked with them. In my second year, in the summer of my second year, I went to Dallas in America and did an internship with Michael Johnson, the sprinter. He has a performance academy there. And that was really my first exposure to elite athletes. When I was there, we had Buddy Hield from the Sacramento Kings was there. There was a really big NFL group. There was some Olympic track athletes, so there's a lot of exposure to high level, and I was 19 at the time, and that really confirmed it for me.
They're just clicked, just
just the 3 months when I was there, I was like, this is definitely what I want to be doing. So I came back, finished my third year, also got some other cool experience whilst I was doing it. I was able to work with some wheelchair basketball athletes alongside, which that was an amazing experience. Hakeem Olajuwon actually lives in Birmingham. Not a lot of people know that. And he runs a basketball camp, so I was able to get some exposure with him, with some of the athletes that he brought in. Then last year, I completed my master's in Loughborough, which is right next to Leicester, which is a very renowned and established like sports science institute. And whilst I was completing my master's, I then interned with the Leicester Riders, who I'm working for currently, gained experience with them. And then luckily, things fell into place when I graduated that the role for the lead strength conditioning coach or physical performance coach opened up. And yeah, I was able to just step right into it. So this was my first season with the Leicester Riders. Ended very, very strangely. So definitely a unique season to be my first. But yeah, that's everything up to this point.
One quick question, or maybe in advance also, maybe for new listeners. Dom always has a lot of questions regarding performance. And I'm sure with just listening to your introduction now, you will probably have a lot of interesting thoughts and brain drops for us on that topic. And usually where I ask questions is more, I would call it maybe the social aspect, psychology-wise and stuff. But yeah, we'll probably just start off with a couple of questions of Dom. But I was just interested real quick in what, can you break down real quick what you wrote your master thesis about, or did you write one?
Yeah, of course. So my master's thesis was, I think it's absolutely fascinating, but basically there's a training method of sprint interval training. So with this, you do a 30-second all-out maximal effort on a bike against a set resistance relative to your body weight. Absolute torture. Uh-huh. So, and then
30 seconds, you're saying?
So yeah, 30 seconds completely all out, and then mm-hmm. you rest for 4 minutes, and then you repeat this. For us, it was a 6-week training session, so it progressed from four sprints a session up until 7 a session. Mm-hmm. But what was unique and is still very, very early in its development is for 2 of the 4 minutes in the experimental group, we used occlusion cuffs to trap the metabolites within the muscle, just to further the stimulus that you received from cycling within mm-hmm. those sprints. So if the 30 seconds wasn't bad enough, now you have 2 additional minutes where your legs are completely on fire. I mean, we had guys throwing up in every session, so really extreme training methods. However, the results are incredible. There's some published research on it that found 5% gains in VO2 max in just 4 weeks. And their participants with VO2 maxes over 60 milliliters per kilo. So
what is VO2 max?
VO2 max, so that's maximal oxygen uptake. So basically that's looking at the amount, the liters of air that your body can use functionally, oxygen within that air. So it's just a performance measure that's used in the physiology world. So your elite athletes are getting up in the 70s and 80s range. So it's the research, and we use well-trained cyclists as well, because really it was just trying to look at how we can apply it to real-life performance, using trained participants.
Wow, that's already really, really deep into a topic.
I was about to say.
But that's fine. I mean, I asked.
to also touch on that, is there, let's say, is there any practical, practical stuff you now use with your players on, specifically
so,
to the study?
So you can do variations of sprint interval training. I think doing a full-on Wingate, so the full 30 seconds, is very, very demanding. Mm-hmm. So I might use that if I have an athlete who's potentially got an upper body injury and, you know, we're rehabbing and I'm looking to make improvements in their conditioning.
Yeah.
But typically, you know, when we condition for basketball players, it's going to be some form of interval training. So I'll use a shortened variant where the sprint is reduced down to more typical segments of duration that you see in basketball. So maybe, you know, 10-second sprint with a reduced recovery time. just because those, like I said, it was really, really taxing protocol on the players. So I do use it. I use a lot of the physiology knowledge that I gained from it to kind of adapt it to a more friendly environment that you can use in season just for a little top up of conditioning.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I jumped ahead, so I also jumped back. How did you meet Dom?
Smart question, Leonard.
Yeah. How do you guys know each other?
So yeah, I met Dom at a performance symposium, which was in London last year. So this was held by, formerly known as Liftora, but now it's called the IBPCC that Thomas and Sam Refson set up. So it's just, they did a touring seminar on basketball performance last summer and went around a lot of different countries. And I met Dom at this seminar when it reached the UK.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because, you know, I obviously during the off season, I always try to, to expand my knowledge, and I always try to go to seminars, and this one happened to be in London. And of course, you know, it was a little bit of travel, but it was definitely worth it. And I would say we stayed in touch. And actually last week, Jordan just sent me an email and was reaching out to me and was asking for a Zoom call. And then we had, Jordan, I just call it a pretty fruitful call. That happened to last, I think, 2.5 hours or something like that. And we were just talking about performance and about his experiences in his first season working as a physical performance coach. And yeah, I mean, we could have talked probably way longer. And after that, you know, Leonard, I talked to Leonard about it, and we were like, hey, we got to get that guy on the show.
I mean, after you guys just talk about this master thesis, I can see this 2.5 Zoom call in front of me.
Definitely.
Yeah, Dom, Dom said, Leonard, you got to stop us if we're starting to run a geek show here. So that's what my job is today. But go ahead, Dom, get us rolling.
Yeah, Jordan. I would like to, you know, it's been 1 year that you worked on a professional level. I would like to know, how would you describe your job? What are the cornerstones for you?
Sure.
Like while working as a physical performance coach.
Yeah. So I'll start with my job. My role is really, like you said, like what the phrase that you like to use, the physical performance coach, that's really what I am. You know, physical performance coach, applied scientist, however you want to put it into practice. Anything regarding performance is what I'm responsible for with the team, which goes from nutrition to sleep to even the latter stages of return to play protocols with the athletes. Anything just outside of pure basketball performance kind of falls under my bracket. And not only do I have the privilege to work with the professional team, we also have an academy of athletes aged 16 to 19. So I'm also in the same role with them. So lots of opportunity to really expand my knowledge for the best use of the athletes and help improve them. But nothing that I do is more important than injury prevention. So I'd say that's the biggest cornerstone for me. And the biggest way that I try and have an impact upon my athletes is to help them stay on the court. Nothing, you know, especially on the professional side, these guys are already professional athletes. You know, yes, I can look to develop them off of the court, but them being able to play is my biggest priority and biggest concern. So that's one of the cornerstones. And then the other one is to just make sure the athletes are in the weight room and develop that buy-in, because everything kind of starts from them being in a weight room. And then from there, you can start to add more and more of kind of what you view as important habits and practices that they need to be doing. But But the analogy I like to use is just, it doesn't matter how good of a practitioner you are if your athlete's not actually doing the work. So I could put together the best program, but if my athlete's in the weight room once a week, then none of it's going to matter. So that's just always my cornerstone, is trying to find that buy-in and trying to get them to come one step at a time, build more and more on their interest and buy into what I'm doing.
That's something we talked about in this podcast already a lot, this buy-in. One, for sure, as a strength and conditioning coach, and in general in the team from the head coach also. Maybe you could talk some about some of your experience in your first year. How did you deal with it? How did you get your players to buy in and actually put in the work they need to put in?
Yeah, of course. So the biggest thing that I just really had to understand first is, you know, what is buy-in? And, you know, buy-in is essentially you're getting the athlete to commit to some form of change. And myself, my interests outside of sport, I'm a very big environmentalist. And one of the big things that you learn to understand and, you know, you get taught is that the main reason why people they're interested in making changes for the planet and helping it, but it's all about the inconvenience of it. You know, it's cycling to work, that's a really big inconvenience, so they're not going to do it. It's changing the diet, a really big inconvenience. So kind of one of the main ways that I went about trying to get buy-in was to try and make my side of things as little as an inconvenience as possible to them. And I think that's just kind of, it's the two approaches. You can either get your athlete to commit, to understand what you're doing more, so that their kind of the commitment outweighs the inconvenience. That's one way. And then the other way is to reduce the amount of inconvenience. So it's trying to do those at the same time, if that makes sense. But kind of, so how I went about my model, my performance model, was trying to make it as athlete-centered as possible and try not to deviate from that, to keep the athlete in the center of the model to get the commitment. And I think that's a really big difference between a sports coach and a performance coach, where, you know, the sports coach is all about getting all the athletes to be in cohesion, and, you know, they have to work for the team for that bigger model. Whereas I feel as a performance coach, I can break it up a little bit more and let the athlete and their needs be the main priority versus the team needs. And that's going to be how I get my best success versus how the team has their best success. And it's kind of two different ends of the spectrum is how I approach it. And I'm just trying to help that athlete bring about the change and for it to be intrinsic, you know? From a basketball standpoint, to go back to the sports coach and the performance coach, you know, if the player doesn't buy into a team, then, you know, that at the end of the day, they're probably, the team's going to move on from that player. But on the performance side, I mean, you can tell me, you've been in the game longer than me, but, you know, most teams aren't going to cut a player if he's not in the weight room, if he's a really good player. So then it's okay, well, I need this athlete to want to be here, and how can I best do that? So Dom and I spoke about bottom up, top down approaches, which is essentially, bottom up is from a programming standpoint is small reacting to the now, and the top down is from planning in the long term. And I think that applies the same to buy-in, where the bottom-up approach is with the athlete in mind, and then the top-down is kind of the culture that you're setting. So how I went about my system and my program was that it was very bottom-up focused, where I tried to build kind of 10, 15 different systems depending on how many players we had on the team. And each system is just completely individual to that player. So, you know, and so the first step, I need to get to know the athlete as an individual for the system to work. So what their needs are, what their goals are, what their likes are, injury history. And it's just trying to build around them what they're going to like the most, but still having that top down where I have my culture of these are what's expected. So it's kind of that partnership building these programs where it's completely individualized and it's, hey, you have ownership over what you're doing, but still needs to exist within these set rules. And the more the athlete's shown commitment, the more freedom, the more individualization. And that's also feedback to me. The more that they're feeding back information, the more that this system can become their own and they have ownership over it. So that's my thoughts. There's a lot of positives to it. There's negatives, like very messy weight room sessions because everyone's on that unique program where it's not everyone following the same set of exercises in the same order. So for me, it made sense to have more individual and small group sessions versus big team sessions. But yeah, that's kind of, that was very long-winded. So I'll let you guys kind of jump on anything you think, but that's kind of the system that I put into place this year.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Leonard. No, you go ahead.
I mean, it's like you said, so much stuff you just said. I could have interrupted five times because I thought it was interesting. One thing that jumped out to me is that you this individual work with players versus what Dom does here, for example, in Göttingen, more the team. The team practices setup. Team setup in the weight room. And because that's not possible, also, like there you gotta communicate with the head coach, right? That it's possible with the schedules and stuff. Because like you said, it's very messy in the weight room, but also very messy on the schedule, probably.
Yeah, so it's kind of just knowing when the team practice is, and film for us is always either leading into practice or following practice. So it's kind of knowing these are set slots where we can't do anything. When do you want to come in and do it? You know,
here's the rule, you have to come in.
Yeah, and then it's on that individual basis. So it's that ownership. Some players like to come in and do it before practice. Some players like to do it after practice. Some players like to do it in the evening.
But like I said, long day.
Yeah, long days. I don't make it easy for myself, but it's just all about that, you know, just making sure they get the stimulus. And also it's not enough just getting the stimulus, are they giving effort? And I've just found the more and more ownership and decisions that the athlete's making over it, the more they're going to, one, be in the weight room, and two, put more effort in when they're in the weight room.
Dom, what's your take on that, being on the other side, also having probably advantages and disadvantages with your, let's call it a model?
Yeah, I mean, what I actually thought about, there's like when I talked to Jordan on the Zoom call, we actually saw differences, and you know, because he is actually able to talk to players and get them into the weight room when they want to come in the weight room or what's most convenient to them. In our setup, that's a little different. And if I had to decide, I mean, we, for example, we have team lifts, so we always have the whole team, 13 to 14 guys in the weight room. That's, of course, different to, you know, having the chance of working with a guy individual or like with two players, three players, whatever.
But Dom, when I played for you, we had sometimes these setups only when there was like a FIBA break or something, where we split guards and bigs. You remember that?
Yeah, that's also something what we sometimes do.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, let's say, I wouldn't consider it the normal setup. The normal setup is most of the time the team setup.
Yeah.
And since Jordan was talking about individualization, that is actually also something I try to do. I always like to use the term diversity, because that's what we physical performance coaches just have to deal with in the weight room, because you know everybody has different preferences. Yeah, everybody reacts to stimuli a little different. So, and that's something I think is really important, that I try to find out what works for each individual best. And this complements probably something that Jordan already talked about. Because when we have a team, like let's say a team lift, the disadvantage, of course, is that I cannot be with everybody. It's just like it is. You know, one guy asked me something. Of course, I'm going to go and help him out. But the session keeps running. So I have to rely on the guys that they also do work independently. But in order for me to achieve that, and that goes back into the buy-in, obviously, that just takes time. You know, I have to be reliable. You know, I have to be organized as a physical performance coach. And over time, when players notice that I'm really, really passionate about these things, then there's a very good chance that they also buy in more into what I'm doing. But at the same time, it always has to be individualized. Jordan, we mentioned it on the podcast also quite a few times already, that autonomy in the weight room is actually also really important, that they can make choices what they think feels best for them in the weight room in order to perform again on the next day in practice or in the game or wherever.
Also something I wanted to jump on while on your last what you said was that you talk to your players before the season and get to know them, and that's something you have in Dom does similar. And we wanted to ask you what is some stuff that you need to know from your player, or what is some important information you need to get before the season?
Yeah, so just something as simple as a conversation like that. Just trying to connect with them, that's obviously an ongoing progress throughout the whole year. So just kind of who they are, why they're here, what's their why, you know, what's their motivation for playing? Because once you figure that out with someone as well, you know, it makes the process a lot easier for trying to build that motivation, and on the low days, being able to remind them of that, whether it's, you know, whether someone's here solely for the income, then you're telling them, hey, if you're doing this, we're going to add years to your career and add paychecks to your career, you know, something as simple as that. So that's always something very very useful. But from a more technical side of things, you know, obviously have to establish injury history. That's probably the biggest factor that's going into all of my programs, current injuries, previous injuries, how I'm going about this, how I'm making sure it doesn't happen again. Then we go through a movement screen. So we're looking at ankle range of motion, hip range of motion, hamstring range of motion, posture assessments, whether there's any anterior pelvic tilt, double leg and single leg squats, just looking for valgus and how this person moves, and looking for any deficiencies. The body composition, which is something that I need to improve on because we didn't really use that throughout the year, and I want to be able to use that. And then we also did some capacity tests as well, more looking for asymmetries with those. And then, so I'm quite lucky where in the preseason this year, and hopefully next year as well, I was given the whole of the first week. So all the on-court work was given to me, so I could just do a conditioning focus, but made it as basketball specific as possible with developmental drills built in as well. But it meant that I could also spread the testing across the week, which isn't a perfect model due to the accumulated fatigue, but it's a lot easier on the athlete, so it's not just one super long, boring testing day. So we'd spread performance tests along this week, so different sprint tests, different jump tests, injury baseline tests as well. So we used a curved linear sprint, so sprinting from one corner of the three-point line to the other, just because that's put so much stress through the lateral ankle, and most athletes are going to have some form of lateral ankle sprain. So that's something that we used as a baseline data. And then I want to add some extra things in for next year, and then a conditioning test. So just kind of, I'm not really doing anything unique or reinventing the wheel with the preseason testing or what I'm trying to learn from the athletes, but just trying to create a clear picture for, so that the first program that they get given is, you know, it matches their needs.
Really, I mean, you mentioned a lot of great things, and there's not much for me to add. If I may add something, what I still do, you obviously said there's the questionnaire, a sort of questionnaire you use regarding previous injury and something like that, or maybe, I'm not sure if it's a questionnaire, maybe it's just the talk you do with them. That's what I also do, because I think that's really important, because that gives you an idea. If you know as a coach, okay, this guy, and I don't know, 2 years ago he had a hamstring strain, or even 3 years ago, that at least to me tells me right away, okay, good, I don't want that to happen again. We need to check that out, and we need to put extra work in that area. Just, you know, as you said in the beginning, you said the prime, or your main cornerstone, or your biggest cornerstone, is the availability of a player during the season, because you obviously don't want that to happen again. So this is something where I always take out information. What I also started doing last year, and there we come back in my questionnaire, I actually asked them what kind of practices they were exposed to in the last 2-3 months, and what kind of shape shape do they think they are. And I obviously also asked them about preferences in the weight room, because I just want to know. I want to know if this guy likes, you know, I'm not a big back squat guy, but if I have a guy who likes to back squat, and let's say he has done it his whole career already and he really feels good with it, then I would be the last guy who is going to take that away from him. That's why this is something I always want to find out before the season starts. And the other thing I might start doing next year, I'm maybe going to present a little sleep questionnaire to the guys, because, you know, like Jordan also mentioned earlier, that all these lifestyle factors, especially sleep, they come into play, especially when we talk about availability of players.
That's Dom's favorite topic, this sleeping. Kind of glasses are you wearing before you go to bed?
Jordan.
Yeah, I wish I was wearing the blue light blocking glasses. Ah. The amount of times that I had them in my Amazon basket this year, and I've just been staring at that, do I purchase this or not? But I'm assuming that's the answer you were looking for, and yes, it's definitely one where I'm just like, I'm yet to pull the trigger, but it's so it's hugely on my radar.
I have to come up with a little story here. You know, my girlfriend, she was really laughing hard at me when I actually ordered these glasses.
Because they look stupid, let's be honest.
They look, yeah, but, you know, if they do the trick, I'm okay with stupid. Yeah. But then, you know, 2 weeks later, she actually tried them. And now when we come home around 8 p.m. at night, she's right away like, Dom, can you get the glasses, please? Because they seem to help. Also, I had the same story. One of the players, one of our players, he's also hooked. He thinks it makes a difference, and he really likes wearing them before, actually, you know, in the evening, like, let's say 8 o'clock, something like that. So, you know, I always come back, if it helps, do it.
Is that also something you focused on, this sleep, or have you not touched this with your athletes too much?
Yeah, of course. It's definitely something that I've had lots of conversations with athletes about, and it's just kind of understanding there's so many different sleep hygiene techniques. I mean, I could throw together a list of probably, you know, 20 things that an athlete could be doing that's messing up with their sleep. So it's kind of understanding what the problem is. A lot of the time, the athletes that aren't sleeping a lot are the internationals and the Americans who, you know,
jet lag also.
Well, it's jet lag, but then it's also, you know, it's staying a choice. they're staying in touch. They got girlfriends back home, and you know, and I think it can be quite dangerous with them to go in with the approach of, oh, this is a negative, you have to change this, because you know, if they then start doing that, and then now they're worrying about things back at home because they don't have conversations as much as they were during the week, then you know, that could have a bigger detriment to the performance. So it's kind of figuring out which aspects you can change. So something we've talked about is simply just moving our training sessions back for next season.
They were back with convenience, huh?
Exactly. That's the big thing is, you know, is, and you can, there's ways you can look at it. You can go, oh, this guy's a professional, he should be fully bought in, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, we're dealing with humans who are thousands of miles away from their families and support networks. So I think it can be important. I mean, this is just one example. There's obviously different examples where people have different reasons why they're not sleeping well, but it's just those conversations, which is a big one. Which you just got to understand their routine, how they're going about things. Such a big one with athletes is naps. You know, you can talk to these guys and, yeah, after practice, I have like a 3-hour nap. And I'm going, okay, like, that's why you're not sleeping well at night. That's a very simple thing to fix. So, but I know that Dom does some awesome things with infographics and player information. So that's something that I'm definitely, after our conversation, definitely going to be borrowing some of those ideas.
Leonard, if you believe it or not, Jordan learned something from me, but I learned way more from him, I have to admit. But yeah, this is actually what you just touched upon. For me, I look at it in regards to sleep, you know, I think you have to create some sort of awareness to players. And this is awareness you create by showing them, for example, infographics, by telling them, for example, about the pros for like maybe just extending their sleep for half an hour or something like that. Yeah. And then on the other side, if you obviously you also want the athletes, what you just said earlier, you want them to commit to change, you know, to commit to changing something in their approach of, for example, sleep. Let's just stay with sleep. And then in order to achieve that, that's also something Jordan and me talked about. It always comes back to context. You gotta present them something that is context related. For example, give them an infographic of some famous quotes from some famous NBA players, how they deal with sleep or what they think of sleep or something like that. Yeah, Jordan, is there also something in regard to context? How do you create context with your players?
Yeah, so I think a really important thing is, like you said, always linking it back to performance, linking it back to health, just making sure they understand you're not just trying to do things to be difficult, that there's a purpose behind this advice that you're giving them. So whether it is sleep as the topic or nutrition or anything, that one, that you're showing that you have done the research is such a big part of it. You know, athletes that are coming from four-year schools and have degrees, and you know, they know not to just blindly follow what you're saying. And that's sometimes the best thing is for your athletes to start questioning what you're suggesting. Because I love those conversations, and then you can get more intricate, more in depth. But yeah, it's just showing that there is evidence behind what you're saying, and that you've done the research. And like you said, link it back. The most classic sleep one is the Andre Iguodala case study about how he was sleeping something ridiculous, like only 3 or 4 hours a night, and then they increased out to 8 hours, and he saw huge improvements in his shooting percentage and playing time, and you know, just like real life examples. And then once they make the way that buy-in occurs is by they then do the new thing, and then they see benefits. And So that's just a big thing, is getting them to just commit to something for a short period of time to begin with. And then if they find the benefit, then it sticks and then it's perfect.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to find something that sparks their interest.
And with that, it's, I mean, everybody is different. Everybody gets sparked by a different topic, I guess. There's one more thing I wanted to talk to you about, or I wanted you guys to talk about, is when I play or when I practice, you know, you always as a player feel how your body feels, if you have a good day, a bad day, and that, like, you feel that pretty early in the practice. And something I noticed is I feel always, or I have my best days usually, if I manage to work out right before practice in the weight room. And I don't know, I do like a 30 minutes, and then I just feel like, I would think, okay, I gotta chill because then I'm tired for practice, but it's actually the opposite. If I have a really good 30 to 45 minute workout, I feel, my body feels great during practice, during team practice. And I know that's something you guys talked about. I think the effect is called post-activation potentiation. Let me know what is going on there with my body, because I don't think this is, how do you say, Zufall, random. All right.
Yeah, I mean, Jordan, that's, I really loved, like, listening to you while you were talking about that phenomenon. So the stage is yours.
Yeah, all right, I'll jump on this, so please just jump in whenever.
Yes,
because I'm sure I can just go off on a huge rant about it. But so yeah, this concept of potentiation is, its definition is that it's force produced by a muscle is increased due to previous contractions. So basically, what you've done previously can improve the force, but also rate of force development and the velocity of a fiber shortening too, which is important because that's specific for power. So in order to get this potentiation effect, what you need is a maximal or near maximal excitation of the neuromuscular system. So, but what's really important is that it's excitation. So this is both referring to maximal force, but then also referring to power. But what's really interesting, and Dom and I spoke about before we started, is that, you know, this is a concept that still is looking for more data to validate it. And, you know, from reading research, it's open to a lot of interpretation, and it leads to individual differences in how practitioners are using it. So even down to the potential mechanisms behind it, there's like three or four potential mechanisms why. So one of them is, if we physiology 101, go back to how a muscle contracts and cross bridges, basically the muscle is just more sensitive to calcium, which is released by the muscle. So it means that there's just more cross bridges are formed to the same amount of calcium. Another concept is called the H reflex. And that's basically just an increase in postsynaptic potentials, which means that the spinal system is just, there's just increased excitation. Pronation angles within a muscle, you know, following maximum contractions, they end up, the angle of them ends up being lower, which means that more force is produced towards the tendon. And then kind of what you're touching on as well with it being right before practice is you have a lot of acute benefits. So increased muscle temperature, which just means that the conduction speed of the neuromuscular system is going to be improved. And then you have increased enzymatic activity within the muscle. So I recognize that was super physiology heavy, but they're all potential mechanisms, and it's not set in stone which one. And then also another thing that's very unclear in the research is the time length of the benefits. We have the acute and acute benefits, which research says, you know, if you perform a maximal squat, then if you sit around and rest somewhere between 4 and 12 minutes, your jump height will then be higher, you know.
Yes, but that's what I experienced, because after I lift and then I practice afterwards, that's when I can dunk, because I usually if I don't have a great day, I can't dunk. But if I work out before, I actually can. It's amazing. It's crazy. So would you recommend, you just touched on it, doing it also before a game? Because that's a really, really high pressure in general on the body. And then I could imagine that, I don't know if it still makes sense for an athlete to do like squats or something you said before the game to actually jump higher.
Sorry for interrupting, Leonard. Let's just keep thinking about that question. I'm just not sure if all the listeners really grasp the concept of it, because there's one book that I would like to quote. It's the book Triphasic by Carl Dietz. In his book, he gives a really easy example of what this concept tries to embody. And I'll just try to frame it as I read it, because that's really easy to understand. So just imagine you are loading boxes of bricks into a car. And you have loaded several boxes. When you go to pick up another box, that's maybe mislabeled. Yeah. And instead of bricks, this box is loaded with pillows. You then grab the box and you maybe nearly fall over backwards, because it comes flying off the floor, because you thought you were going to lift off something really heavy, but then it's only pillows. But you were potentiated from lifting the other boxes before that were really heavy. So, and then, good example. Then you could say you were potentiated from lifting the heavier boxes first. Does that make sense?
For sure. This really explains it well.
That is just something I want to throw at you, because that probably makes it, it's just, yeah,
that's
easier.
That everybody has felt before this, lifting some heavy objects, and then, yeah. Yeah,
but Leonard, please go back to your question.
Yeah, Jordan, I think you remember doing it before the game. Is the effect long enough?
Yeah, so what's been found is this effect. So the potentiation can last from immediately after doing it up until some papers have found that you can be potentiated up to, you know, 1 to 2 days after. Ooh. Doing this potentiation exercise. So something that I use is both the day before a game, I'll do a potentiation lift, and then athletes who are comfortable with doing it, a potentiation lift on the game day. So you kind of have those two stimulus. So the one on the day before would be more of a training stimulus. So I put all my power work that I do with my athletes that goes at the end of the week before the game, so that I can do all of my strength and taxing stuff that's going to make athletes sore as far away from the game as possible. And then this power stuff is going to be exercises that aren't going to cause, you know, a lot of muscle damage and a lot of soreness carrying over into the game, because you want them feeling the best as they can, like Dom spoke about. So I use that more as training. So I'm getting all my power stimulus, so I know that I'm getting it because it's something I do want to work on. But I also know that there's going to be a potential benefit the next day. And then also on the game day, I'm going to do something very similar, but also just making sure the game day one's going to be a bit less taxing, because like you said, I don't want to overdo it and then affect performance, because like you said, game days are very heavy. So to give more of a practical example, the day before, I like to use something called French contrast training. Okay. And
you have to explain this though.
Yeah, sure. I jump on this. So it's based on what's called the force velocity curve. So this is just a graph where on the y-axis you have force, and then on the x-axis you have velocity. So the higher the force of something you're doing, the lower the velocity, and the top will be when the velocity is zero and you're doing a maximal isometric. Mm-hmm. And then you got all the way down to the other end where you're doing something like a band-assisted jump, which is something I use during French contrast, where you're below, you're at a very low force, but the velocity is super, super high. So what French contrast training is...
Sorry. It's because it's assisted, right?
Assisted, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's reducing your body weight. So it means when you're jumping in the ground, there's less force than you'd normally produce when you're jumping, but it means that you can go quicker. So with French contrast, what you do is you have four exercises performed in almost a circuit fashion with a little bit of rest between them. And they, I like to call it surf the force velocity curve, because it's a curve versus a straight line on this graph. So I like to call it surfing the force velocity curve, because that's what you do with these exercises. So on I always have some form of a maximal isometric. So this is a way that I can guarantee that I'm getting 100% force production. So whether this is a three-quarter squat or a isometric mid-thigh pull, that's my maximal force one that I was talking about. So where velocity is zero and force is 100%, because I know the athlete's going to reach that. And then step down, I do a band-resisted jump. So this is keeping them down on the ground, so they have to overcome more force than they normally would, but they're still jumping, so there's still more velocity. Then I go down to a band-assisted jump, so that's as light as it can be, as quick as it can be. Then as a personal preference, I like to do a sprint, because you've got this potentiated feel in your body, and now you're applying it to something athletic, and you, as an athlete, and this is still on this force velocity curve, this is still high velocity, and you're still training yourself, but as an athlete as well, you feel that increased athleticism as well when you pull it at the end. And then you rest 3 minutes between each circuit. And why I like to do this on the day before game day is, you know, I can call it there. If that's all the athlete wants to do, that's 10 minutes of work. It really hasn't been too taxing whatsoever. But there's really, there's quite a few papers where training with French contrast improves your power output. So I'm both potentiating for the game with that in mind, and then I'm also improving their athletic capabilities. So it's kind of getting two in one, and I'm structuring my week based upon that.
And so let me, you this French contrast training, now let's say somebody is listening, maybe not playing already at a level where he can ask a coach about this practice style, and more has maybe already his routines that he does, like he has two workouts that he does during the week. Would you recommend him to do some of that before a game or the day before a game? Or would you say, well, you're not doing this maybe as correct or something. Maybe you do too much, or something that you could do wrong that you would not recommend doing that? Or...
Yeah, so with the French contrast, I tend to use that for my more advanced athletes.
Mm. I was about to say,
Just because it's, you know, it's taxing on the neuromuscular system, and it requires them to be able to recruit muscles in the way that you want them to. However, what I do with my athletes who aren't as well trained and aren't going to respond as well as to it as this, because, you know, if you do too much the day before, it can actually have a negative effect. So
yeah,
trying to make sure to balance that. So for my less trained athletes, what I'm going to do is just break it up a bit more. Maybe not put as four exercises in, and maybe just have a resisted jump and an unresisted jump, you know, and get all, I'm going to do a maximal force and then a body weight jump, and kind of leave it just there and not go to that next extreme where it's completely going on the force velocity curve.
Okay.
So that's kind of the advice. But we also do basically what I just described. That's essentially what we're doing on a game day. So I still do maximal force just because of how it's defined in the research. You do tend to need something maximal. So what our athletes do that lift on game day is they do a pin quarter squat. So the bars are starting on the rack, on the safety bar, and then they're exploding up. And we load this up really heavy. So we're only doing, you know, one to three reps of this. And we're using this, the training. Some of our athletes gained 60 kilos on this lift throughout the season. And, you know, nothing. And why I like doing it as a squat, and it's in this, number one, it's in this quarter squat. So we're not going in ranges which are going to put a lot of stress on the hips or on the lower back. But, you know, having some of the players are lifting up upwards of 250 kilos. So having that on your shoulders before a game, nothing's going to, you know, activate your core like that. Or, you know, like what Don was saying, it's a perfect analogy for the picking up the boxes. Well, if I can go in the exact range that I jump, if I do that before a game with 250 kilos, when I go to jump in a game, I'm going to feel as light as a feather.
Yeah.
So we kind of take the same force velocity concept and just break it down and make it easier. So we'll do the pin quarter squat. We'll do some form of Olympic lift, whether they can snatch, they will snatch. If they can't, it'll be a dumbbell snatch. Have a drop jump in there. Have some core stuff. They obviously have their prehab to get ready, and then that's it. So on a game day, you know, they're getting done with their lift 10, 15 minutes. We're not doing too many exercises because, like you said, I don't want to fatigue them on a game. But for sure that this can be something to improve your performance in a game. But like I said, with the training, if you're an untrained person and you do this before a game, you're going to feel fatigued.
Yeah.
You know, so it's something that I tried to start as early as possible. Preseason games, it's, hey, please come in, please try this if it's something you like, because everyone has their game day routines and
trying to be built in.
Exactly, yeah. And trying to change someone's game day routine in season, you know, good luck with that. So it's finding the ways that you can, when you can get it. So preseason was a huge one for us.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Got it.
Interesting what you said about the pin squat that guys during the season improved like by 60 kilogram that they were able to to add that on during the season, because most of the time when people talk about in-season lifting, I always hear the word maintain, and I don't really like it. Sometimes I also do say it because there's just maybe not a better word, but that's a really good example of guys can actually improve even during the season.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm with you. I'll upgrade that, okay? I not only don't like it, I hate it. You know, our in season, we're with the athlete for such a longer period than we are with the off season. And, you know, some teams, they don't even have contact with their athletes in the off season. So for some players, if they're a new signing, the only time I have to work with them is in season, you know. Yep. So
same here.
I don't have anything to maintain per se. So in that scenario, so you know, I'm obviously going to be very conscious of, especially with their lower body load. That's something that you have to be very aware of with basketball players because it's a very taxing sport. But you know, we're not just trying to keep what you already have. If we're around each other and if you're bought into the program, then there's no reason why, especially in basketball where, you know, all practitioners are kind of agreed on that what we need to make sure we're giving the athletes is maximum force because they don't get that on the court. So, you know, we're all doing that as practitioners. So if we know this and we're trying to develop this, then I want them to be getting better.
Yeah, interesting stuff. To wrap up our thoughts or your thoughts basically on the post-activation potentiation, we could finally say that resistance training, you should not only view that as, let's say, fatigue-inducing activity, but you can, but you also have to see it as a, how should I put it, like a necessary performance improving activity. That's basically what you said.
I love that. That's a perfect summary of it.
Yeah, but there's obviously more than meets the eye. You have to know your athletes, of course. Like you said, you really have to introduce it gradually. And if they really start liking it, well, of course. Then we talk about buy-in again, huh?
Yep. always comes back to buy-in and them understanding why.
We keep touching on this so every episode, basically. If we have a coach here, if we have a strength and conditioning coach, if we have a player, it's always back to buy-in, basically. Dom, do you have a still maybe one more question you really wanted to ask, or have we already through your script?
No, I mean, I have one more thing, and that has actually one person ask me about that topic. That's why I would really like to bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's off-season training. I mean, we have talked a lot about in-season training, but I think we have never touched upon off-season training. Jordan, do you want to take the lead on that? I like the word cornerstones. What are your cornerstones for off-season training? You just said you...
I mean, do you even have athletes in off-season? Like, not from the team, right? It's maybe then individual, other clients, or
how does that work? I do have athletes in the off-season. Sorry, I should clear that up. The example I used was if, you know, we signed someone new and I never worked with them before. Okay. So... I mean, I'm currently doing what I can with the off season at the moment when everything's shut down. But typically, it's when it comes to off season, it's the first thing is just letting the athletes know that, you know, now strength conditioning holds more of a priority. Not to say that this is the only priority, and you know, but players use the off season to improve their game, and you have to appreciate that. But the big thing of in season, and I know that Dom's spoken about this a lot, where, you know, you're always conscious about what they're doing on court the next day, whether it's practice or playing a game, whereas in the off season, that's less of a worry. So, you know, you're able to expose the athlete to more, whether that's more volume, more intensity. More, a big one for me in the off seasons is putting in a lot of eccentrics, and that's for tendon health. That's making sure that they can tolerate the load for the upcoming season. But, you know, in season, that's not as much of an option because of the soreness that carries over. So that's always a big one. And making sure the athletes understand that, you know, hey, I'm not going to kill you, but, you know, you're going to feel more of after each session than you normally would in season. But it's because now we're more of an equal priority.
Yeah, that's interesting what you're saying. What I always like to use for in-season training, and this is also something I stole. I haven't made that up myself. I like to protect athletes from the downside in season, from the downside, like you just said, soreness on the next day. This isn't something I would like because I want them to be 100% ready when practice starts. But during the off season, since there is no competitive basketball practice on the next day where they need to showcase themselves for playing time, you actually have more room so you can pursue the upside a little more. You know, you can have higher volumes of lifts in the gym. You can have soreness on the next day. This is all possible in the off season.
Yeah. So was it looking for kind of insights into what we're doing in the off season with the athletes?
I have one quick question. How do you about that statement Dom just made. Do you want soreness in the off season?
You go ahead, or
you go ahead, Dom. I think I was directed to you.
I mean, don't get me wrong. This is nothing I really want. You know, it's not that, you know, guys, today we're going to do this. You know, this is on the menu for today. I want you to be so sore tomorrow. Of course not. I would never want that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you have a little bit more volume, for example, there might be little soreness on the next day. But I won't be as concerned as I might would be during the season, I mean.
Yeah, but that's not something you're actually looking for. Yeah.
No. Yeah. No,
because that's something, you know, looking back at the beginning of my career, that's something I definitely did wrong. I mean, I had no athletic coach. I mean, I was living with you, Dom, but that you were back in your baby shoes, let's say.
Exactly.
And that's what something I was looking for as a player. I tried to go as hard as possible in the weight room because I, you know, I lived by the sentence, basically, the more the better, you know. And but that's definitely something I guess you guys would rip apart.
Yeah, I mean, my athletes might say something different because they will think that is my sole purpose in life to make them sore. But yeah, no, I'm with Dom there. You know, it's just like it's an unfortunate side effect, and it's gonna be something they feel more in the off season, and especially for me because, you know, I have more to play with, so. Like Dom said, whether it's the volume or for me, I'm going to put more eccentric work in the off-season programs, which by nature is going to make them more sore through tempos and or even true eccentrics is something that I was starting to use in the off-season before the whole country got locked down. but yeah, so it's just an unfortunate consequence.
Yeah, and one thing I also like to say when it comes to off-season training, you know, the sport of basketball, there's just no way that you can simulate that. You know, no training in the world will make you ready what's going to happen on the basketball court. But what you can do during the off-season, you can get your workload up that your body is at least used to a certain workload throughout the last, whatever weeks you have, hopefully you have 12 weeks or maybe even longer, so that the gap from what you are used to do the last 12 weeks when preseason starts is not as big, so that you're just a little bit more robust. You know, I always use these words, they're from Mladen Jovanovic, one of the really great guy, great author of different books. And if somebody's interested, you should definitely check these books out.
Yeah, that's a good thought to put this topic maybe to an end. Or is there something you wanted to add, Jordan?
No, not really. I mean, it's just, yeah, reinstating that. And from a practitioner standpoint, it's good to know what your athletes were experiencing in season and what a heavy week looks like, whether that's distance or however you monitor your athletes, so that in your off season you can, you know what you have to work up to, which, you know, it's the exact same thing as what Dom was saying with keeping them ready. But if you're, the more you do in season in terms of monitoring, the easier it's going to be to know if you're where you should be with your athletes.
Yeah, you have more data. Yeah.
Really a good, really nice quote I like to use. Maybe that's also something to wrap it up. I think you as a coach, you should not be married to anything other than what's going to work for your athletes.
Definitely. Can't agree more.
Guys,
I think this was a good wrap up, Dom.
Yeah. Oh, we have one more question left, of course, Jordan. You have another nomination for us?
I do. I have to nominate Thomas Huey. He was the guy who brought us two together. So, and he's an incredible practitioner. So I know he's got so many interesting things to say as well for the podcast. But yeah, he was the reason why we met, so it would feel wrong to nominate anyone else.
That's a great nomination. from my side already, thanks so much for coming. I thank you. You really brought a lot of interesting thoughts to us. I hope some listeners have picked up some stuff they haven't thought about before. So we do our jobs of giving people brain drops. Yeah, that's it from me. Dom, you have the last word as always.
Jordan, I really appreciate you coming on. It was a lot of brain drops or brain candy, whatever you want. No, we're going to have to call it brain drops, of course. Thanks again, and stay in touch.
Of course. Thank you so much. Stay safe, guys. Same to everyone listening. But yeah, I really appreciate the time, and I enjoyed this conversation so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya. Bye.